Bluff Congregation of the Lord, Daniel 6 probably provides the easiest word association test in the entire Bible. Children, the game goes like this. I say one word and you think of the first thing that comes to your mind. And if I say the word Daniel, the first thing we all think of is the lion's den. This is probably the most well-known part of the entire account of Daniel and one of the favorites in the Bible. Children, maybe some of you are thinking, this is my favorite chapter in the whole Bible. You know, it actually makes it a difficult chapter to work on because the things we know best or think we know best, we start to make assumptions about. You know how often a counselor puts a finger on a sore spot in someone's life, and the reaction comes, I had no idea, I didn't see it coming. You see that person every day. And sometimes by being so close, you don't see things as clearly. We also have to avoid the danger in this chapter. We can't reduce this chapter or any part of this book to the slogan, dare to be a Daniel. Pray like Daniel, live like Daniel. Because if that's all you hear and notice, you're missing the gospel in this book. Daniel 6 is not a spiritual high jump bar. Young people remember it maybe from sports day at school. This chapter doesn't exist to raise the bar really high for us to try to jump over. That would be too high for you, and you would be left with one of two things, the bitter disappointment of not jumping this high, or worse yet, the blind illusion that you did it. If you reduce the gospel in any chapter of the Bible to do this and don't do that, be this and don't be that, you turn the gospel into what one man perceptively called killer bees. You've heard of the Africanized honeybee that you can't manage and that kill people with their stings. Be this, be this, be this. The Bible should never be reduced to the bees. So then what's the main point of this chapter? I'm glad you asked. It's about the great faithfulness of the living God to his pilgrim people in a hostile world. And it's this faithfulness of God that is the anchor, and it's the fountain of the faithfulness of his people. Every time you see a faithful follower of the living God, you should ultimately see behind that the faithfulness of God himself. And that's the most humbling and encouraging way to say it, because it means God gets all the glory, and it means his people get maximum comfort. So here's our theme, the faithful God and his faithful Daniel. We see distinguishing faithfulness, threatening faithfulness, vindicated faithfulness. The faithful God and his faithful Daniel. Distinguishing, threatening, and vindicated faithfulness. So put on your thinking cap for a moment and remember the vision of Daniel 2. Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold and the statue, he's now been replaced, just as God said, by the body of silver, the Medes and the Persians. Kings again are coming and going. Empires are falling and rising. But the King of Kings who holds the reins and knows the end from the beginning is still on the throne. He's building his church. He's fulfilling his promises. He's comforting his people. And that powerful faithfulness of God, that almighty faithfulness, is the greatest comfort to his people in this world. Isn't that why, if you fear and love this God, you become faithful even in the chaos of this world? Here's Daniel before another world ruler, Darius the Mede, and liberal scholars are always quick to manufacture objections, and they claim we can't find any evidence in archaeology and history that this person existed. See, Daniel's just full of made-up stories. I won't bore you with the whole list of the possible solutions, but the most convincing seems to be this. Darius is the Persian name of the man known in history as Gobryas. He was a Babylonian general, and he got so sick and tired of the playboy king Belshazzar that he defected to the Medes and Persians and was rewarded by being made regent of Babylon on behalf of Cyrus. He, of course, remembered the glory days of Nebuchadnezzar, and he then would have known of Daniel. He was already 62 at this point and was not in charge for long, because eventually Cyrus himself takes over. But this Darius, to use his Bible name, was a capable man. He reorganizes Babylon. Now, every time a great civilization falls, it always falls for the exact same reasons. It becomes corrupt, greedy, and selfish. People lose the discipline, the drive, and the ethics and morals that led to success. You see the same thing in families. One generation works really hard, builds a business, makes a lot of money. And if the next generations are not carefully managed, they learn to spend but not to earn. They learn to love luxury but not hard work. And within a couple generations, the whole family fortune is gone. And governments and nations do the same thing. Government remains the most wasteful, corrupt, foolish, and inefficient spender of money on the planet. And not much has changed. And that's why the first thing that Darius does in verse 2 is he wants to stop the losses. He wants to stop the corruption. So he has these satraps or princes, 120 of them, each over a district. They're supposed to make sure the taxes get gathered and forwarded to the capital. Now, in that part of the world, as still in Africa and many other places, corruption was the key. I was talking once to a man who works at a foundation over there, and he had showed a picture of the chief of the village making a speech that the UN says we shouldn't be corrupt, and this is going to be a village with no corruption. And all the people were smiling because they knew that he was the most corrupt person in the whole province. That's how it worked in Babylon. They would keep and enrich themselves on government money. And to make sure that these princes don't act like that chief in the African village, Darius says, I'm going to appoint three presidents, if you will, or governors, so that they can keep an eye on the 120 chiefs. And these three have to be absolutely beyond any corruption. Daniel's one of them. We already read in chapter 3 that Daniel was promoted above the presidents. You could translate, he distinguishes himself above the rest. He is very good at sniffing out corruption and waste. He won't tolerate it. He won't pretend he doesn't see it. He won't just say, well, that's the cost of doing business. He might be 80 years old by now, but his mind is as sharp as ever. And Daniel is so good at what he does that Darius says, I'm going to make you the chief of these governors. You're going to be the second in command in the whole country. Now stop and think about what temptations Daniel has resisted. How easy it would be, to use a contemporary example, for Daniel to think these Babylonians, Medes, and Persians stole from my people. Jewish lives matter, #. I'm going to get some of it back for me and for my people. But he doesn't. Daniel does his best, not just for Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, but for Darius and the next empire. Why? Because that's what God told him to do. Jeremiah 29, we read it, the letter to the exiles. What does God say to them? You're going to be there for a while. Settle down, build houses and farms, get married, have children. Verse 7, seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to dwell. I've brought you a captive there. Pray to the Lord for the well-being of Babylon. Because when it does well, you'll do well too. Daniel does his best because God planted him there and God put him there to seek the best for a city in which he's a captive exile. Can such things be said about us too? The New Testament church is described like this, as pilgrims, strangers, exiles. Integrity is becoming as rare in Canada as it was in Babylon. Because a pagan culture, and that is what Canada is, we need to stop thinking of ourselves even as a post-Christian nation, because we're not. We are a pagan country, and in a pagan country, corruption flourishes. Every politician has a shelf life. Every single one of them, in the end, because of scandals, is unelectable again. Do you realize the temptations in the workplace? You know that managers say that because of smartphones and the abuse of them during working hours, you're having a really good day if you get 6 hours of work out of somebody you're paying 8 hours to work. In fact, some sporting events like the NCAA basketball tournament are broadcast live with a so-called boss button. And if you see your boss coming, you click one button and the sound and video disappears until he's gone again. Our entire economy prices things about 20% higher than they should, and they call it the theft surcharge because they got to make up for shoplifting by employees and customers. So everything you buy costs 20% more than it should for that reason alone. People claim sick days when they're not sick. They pad expense accounts and submit receipts and claim hours that they didn't work. Do you know that too many professing Christians act this way too? Listen to how people talk. Sometimes they've said it to me. I can't avoid sin at work. Yeah, Pastor, you can use nice words on the pulpit about integrity, but that only works in the pulpit. It doesn't work in the real world. And you have your nice desk job and everything runs smoothly in your office, but I have to be out there. It's impossible to succeed as an honest businessman, one man told me. If I wasn't paid by somebody I delivered product to, then I'm justified in not paying one of my suppliers because it's not fair that I should bear the expense, and so I'll just pass it on to some other guy. Or to quote another man, business is business and church is church. Let's keep the two separate. And so people take advantage of each other and find loopholes and maybe they can find a loophole, and yet it's actually not right before God. Or business owners pay their employees as little as they can get away with and take advantage of them, especially when jobs are hard to come by. And some church members want to get their hands on everything they can gain. Just like the 120 princes of Daniel, and the world sneers, he calls himself a Christian, and she even goes to church. And all he cares about is money, and sometimes it takes a very subtle form. You'd never charge a person a dollar less or a dollar more than you should, but you certainly wouldn't charge him a dollar less than you can either. And sometimes these accusations from the world are painfully accurate. Daniel was a man of integrity as a youth and just as much in his old age. You know, I listened to one seasoned pastor comment on how rare that is in the church. He says this, many great men who begin well don't end well. They cut corners conscience would not have allowed when they were younger. They start to excuse crooked things and dishonesty and deceit. But we sang from Psalm 92, the Sabbath psalm, that the righteous will bear fruit in old age. Why? To fill their trophy case with bragging rights? No, listen, I quote, to show that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. When your life is built on this rock, you long to show by how you deal with each other and the world that he is upright. Built on him, I reflect him. Can that be said about you? Do you stand out in this world for your honesty and your integrity in the workplace? Is your life built on the rock of an upright Lord in whom there is no unrighteousness? A question like that both humbles us and points us to the solution for our own crookedness, the Lord's upright character and redeeming power. Another application. What are we supposed to be doing in a world in which the New Testament calls us to live as pilgrims and exiles? Are we to run from the world? Are we to take over the world and redeem and Christianize the culture? Are we to change the world so that we aren't so uncomfortable in the world? Should you as an employee say, I'm going to make this business a Christian business. I'm going to take it captive for Christ. Jesus doesn't pray in John 17 that his people would be taken out of the world, but that they would be preserved in it. We are told to be in the world, to care about what's happening in the world, but not to imitate the world. To be in it and not of it, to live a godly life built on the upright rock of God. A believer in a crooked world should be like a boat on the water. The problem's not when the boat's on the water, the problem is when the water's in the boat. Daniel's faithful. He's a sharp accountant. He does his best. Glorifying God where he puts you is a beautiful thing. You don't have to be a missionary, a martyr, or a pastor to serve the kingdom well. Sometimes it means being faithful in crooked business to the best of your ability. Refusing to be corrupted, doing your best for an ungodly boss. Of course, to run away from a call to the ministry is sin, but to serve God where he places you is also a beautiful thing and is also a calling. Isn't showing the Lord is upright and a rock, the rock on which your life is built, a worthwhile calling? In a crooked world, Daniel stands out. Darius values him highly, but not everyone does. Our second point, we see that Daniel's and God's faithfulness are threatening. The 120 satraps are not fans of Daniel. In fact, they're downright annoyed, to say it politely. He's ruined their opportunity to enrich themselves at government expense. And of course, they make their speeches about how corruption is wrong, but they don't mean a word of it. They might say, we're fighting for the people. We're doing this for the people. But that's code in Babylon for looking out for myself. And they say to themselves, what's the point of being a satrap if you can't dip your hand into the public money? And so the world does what it always does. They want to find corruption in Daniel, because then they can hold it above his head and blackmail him to look the other way. See, the world thinks all these pious people, they're just fakes. They're just sneakier than we are, but they're doing the same thing everybody else does. Everybody looks out for number one. Talk about integrity and then act sneaky. And sadly, there are such church members. But in verse 4, we find the first miracle in this chapter. Don't go running off to the lion's den at the end. There's many a wonder to be enjoyed before we ever get there. The miracle is a squeaky clean politician. The princes do their security check of government files. We're going to find something that's going to bring Daniel down. They hire the Babylonian equivalent of a private detective or a muckraking journalist. They sneak a peek into Daniel's garbage and look through his papers when he's not home. We would say today they hack his email and his computer, and they dig everywhere they can. And they find exactly nothing. But before we read the summary of their report, why are they doing this? Why are they threatened by Daniel's integrity? Shouldn't they say, you know what, this man is good for the kingdom? But honestly, the only kingdom they care about is the kingdom of me. And therefore, they have to get rid of Daniel. But the deeper reason is that the world hates God and therefore hates his people too. And when people live clean, moral, faithful, upright, self-denying, humble, honest lives, that convicts the conscience of those who walk in darkness. It exposes their own ugliness, and they hate it. Young people, this is a lesson you'll have to painfully learn. This world isn't any friend of grace. Often they make fun of it. The faithful people of God can be made the targets of hostility and persecution. Isn't this why atheists are so obnoxious and difficult, many of them? I read about a man this week. He had done a great accomplishment in the climbing and hiking world, and I thought, who is him? So I looked it up a little more. And he describes himself as aggressively and militantly and viciously anti-religion. One man once asked an atheist, why are you so evangelistic? If you think that God is just an imaginary friend, but if he helps people, why do you care? It's a good question, isn't it? Do you want to know the summary of the books of the famous atheists of our times? There is no God and I hate him. Signed, Sam Harris. There's no God and I can't stand him. Signed, Richard Dawkins. I even pay money for billboards proclaiming there's no God so I can yell it at people whom I never meet. It's funny that someone who doesn't exist creates such a strange reaction in you. When I first moved to Abbotsford in BC, I was in the hardware store that first week and I met a man who was so friendly. We had a really nice conversation and I just moved here. Yeah, great. And BC, it's a great place. You'll love it. And on and on. And then finally he got around to saying to me, what do you do? What brings you here? And I said, well, I'm the pastor of a church. And he looked at me and he said, people like you are the cause of all the trouble in the world. And then he left in a huff. He was mad. And he came back down to me the next aisle again. People like you are the cause of all the trouble in the world. And he marched off again. That's actually pretty mild compared to what many believers suffer in this world. Christians do get, in a pagan country, they do get fired, harassed, and hated. And people attempt to use the force of the government to do it. In Grand Rapids, the government threatened to shut down a slaughterhouse owned by somebody in our Grand Rapids church because they had a pamphlet about marriage that was not in favor of gay marriage. The meat inspectors were there to look at the meat, but the Obama administration gave them the power to force social issues too. And they said, we're going to shut down you down, and none of your employees will have work unless you get these things out of here. In East Lansing, a farmer was told, you're not allowed to sell blueberries anymore in the farmer's market because on your private Facebook page, you said you don't support gay marriage. Young people, don't be surprised when this world is hostile. Stand in a pro-life chain. Go to a university with CCBR or some other pro-life organization. You realize how hostile sinners are to God and his people. I know someone who's highly trained in creation science and does outdoor creation evangelism here in Ontario. And the dirty looks and the hateful words this polite, kind, well-spoken man gets are incredible. Should it be incredible? God said in Genesis 3, I will put hostility between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Jesus said, if they persecuted me and looked, in my words, hunting for a way to trip me, they will persecute you and try to trap you too. He even said, you'll be hated by all men for my name's sake. If you're going to be in the world and yet not of the world, you are going to face people who can't stand the sight of you. Let's not buy into this myth that says, as long as I'm faithfully serving God and loving people, then God has to bless me and He'll make my life smooth and everybody will like me. And if I serve Him faithfully, He'll make sure I get the promotion, I'll get the point of influence, I'll get the honors. Listen, faithfulness to God in this world will produce two reactions in the world. There will be people who value and respect you, like Darius and even Nebuchadnezzar valued Daniel. And there will be people like those 120 princes who can't stand the sight of God's people. Don't be surprised when you are mocked, isolated, silenced, and put down in the workplace and in the university. Don't be surprised at conflict at work. Remember working at FedEx, and we could discuss every subject, and we did, and people sometimes would bring up the most vulgar, crude things. But I started having a conversation with one person about God and His Word, and one of the managers said, we don't talk about that here. You're allowed to discuss everything else. Don't be surprised when corrupt, depraved people hold you to a very different standard than they hold themselves. A young Christian once got a machinist job. He worked so hard. He wanted to do his best, and he was producing so well. And a couple of the unionized employees came to him and warned him, you're working too hard. You're working too fast. You're making us work bad. We're telling you, slow down and take it nice and easy. But he was serving God. He felt he couldn't do that. So finally, someone walked over to his tool rack, grabbed a tool, and shoved it into the running machine, ruining it. When the boss investigated, everyone else said, no, we didn't see anything. We were all just minding our own business. And now the employee was left to explain how a machine worth tens of thousands of dollars busted when all their coworkers said, we didn't see anything. And don't be surprised if Christians will sometimes get busted by the boss for things that 10 other people are doing in plain sight and they get away with it. I know a man who lost his job that way. And someone might want to say, but God has to stop these things. Why does He let them get away with it? Where has God ever promised to stop everything and correct everything in this present world? He hasn't. He will set the record straight. He will silence gossiping or slandering tongues. He will, but not necessarily right now. Why not? Because the opposition of the world to His people vindicates the faithful on Judgment Day and increases the condemnation of the wicked on Judgment Day. And God is most concerned with Judgment Day and life after that. Is He not being faithful to His promised Judgment Day when He builds ample evidence to convict the ungodly and ample evidence to demonstrate the faithfulness of His people? Now, that doesn't mean He turns a total blind eye to such things now. But God uses these things to make sure His pilgrims remember. There are times when pilgrims say, you know, I really don't feel all that much at home in Canada. It's actually a blessing when it's for spiritual reasons. This isn't my home. Because now you remember you're a pilgrim. Now you remember to pray for the coming of Christ. Now you remember there's another city where I'm headed. And that's when you can do the most good in the world. God is faithful to keep his pilgrim people living like pilgrims. But it isn't the only way he demonstrates his faithfulness in the face of such hostility, because the threatening faithfulness of Daniel and of God proves to be vindicated faithfulness. Our last point. The muckraking princes have left no stone unturned in Daniel's life, and they can't find dirty laundry. He lives a modest, humble, self-denying, simple, sleaze-free life. He's a man of integrity. He's got nothing to hide. He's the same person in secret as he is in public. And they know it. And they say to each other, "It's pointless to hunt for scandal in that man's life. We won't find any." Why not? Well, they see this clearly too. They realize there's a connection between the lifestyle of Daniel and the law of his God. Daniel cares about serving God more than anything else. And therefore, if they can find a way to make the law of God contradict the law of the land, then they can get him branded as a criminal and removed from office. They didn't intend to do this, but they exposed the very secret of Daniel's faithfulness, and they exposed the very fruitlessness of their own hatred. Since Daniel honors God, God will take care of Daniel. It's striking that the Babylonian name Belshazzar is no longer used of Daniel. The Babylonians are gone, the Medes and Persians are in charge, and Daniel's done with being called Belteshazzar. He's called Daniel. Children, remember the Hebrew name, what it means? God is my judge. And this doesn't just mean God will discipline or punish me if I'm wrong. It means just as much, God will save me and deliver me for glorifying him. Daniel is and remains Daniel. So is that one more trophy to put in Daniel's bragging rights shelf? No. The enemies of Daniel say, "We can't find anything crooked or prosecutable in the court of his life because of his God." They're forced to testify to the uprightness of Daniel, and Christ promises that to his people. Listen to Isaiah 54, verses 15 to 17. Isaiah 54, 15 to 17. God says this, "Behold, they will surely assemble, but not because of me. Whoever assembles against you will fail for your sake." We need that kind of encouragement as a church in a culture that is hostile to the people of God. Verse 16, "Behold, I have created the smith who blows the coals in the fire and who brings forth an instrument for his work. I have created the waster to destroy." God is saying, "I raised up that person who thinks he's going to destroy my people, whether he's in charge in government or he's in the workplace or he's your neighbor. But I will use them to forge my people through the furnace into an instrument they never intended." The opponents of God are tools in God's hands. And if you're suddenly placed by God in the forge and in the furnace, in your family circle, in your workplace, in your university, don't be surprised and don't be afraid because of what comes next. Verse 17, "No weapon fashioned against you shall prosper. Every tongue that rises against you in judgment you shall condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is from me, says the Lord." No wonder Daniel learned to be faithful and steadfast, a man of integrity in Babylon. Because God in his word described the dangers ahead of time and promised his help. And in this chapter we see his help. Maybe someone wants to say, "Is this promise really true?" Because people do get fired, fined, harassed, and robbed in this world. God's people do get shot, blown up, martyred, and forced to become refugees. God's people do get treated brutally. Where was God? To answer that, you need more than Daniel. We need to see with New Testament eyes the covenant God on which Daniel's life is built. And we find the secret in a word I've skipped until now in Daniel 6, verse 3. Daniel distinguishes himself because an excellent spirit was in him. Read the word spirit with a capital S. The Holy Spirit is at work in Daniel. Daniel, the lover of the law of his God, is filled with the spirit of his God. And with New Testament eyes, this Spirit has a very specific identity. He's the Spirit of Jesus Christ that rests on Daniel, molding Daniel into the image of Jesus Christ. He has only one blueprint in Old or New Testament to conform people to Christ. The enemies of Daniel said there's no fault in him, but Daniel doesn't say that about himself. If you read Daniel 9, we'll hear him plead with tears on his knees, confessing his sins and the sins of the people of Israel. But Jesus was truly without sin at all. Jesus could ask what Daniel never did. Looking at his enemies, Jesus says to them, "Which one of you can convict me of sin?" Not just of breaking the law of the land, but of sin against God. Pilate, his judge, said, "I find no fault in him at all." Jesus was faithful as a servant and as the Son of God. What did his faithfulness earn him? The high priest couldn't find two witnesses to agree of what Jesus said was wrong, so he paid them to tell lies. He put Jesus under oath and said, "You have to tell me, are you the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "Yes, I am what you say. And you will see me at the right hand of God in power as the Son of Man, as the judge of the living and the dead." And the high priest rips his robes in false rage and says, "Jesus has blasphemed. He's got to die. The beloved Son of God, in whom he is well pleased, is crucified in shame." He dies the death of the guilty and the corrupt. That wasn't the end of the story. It was the goal of the story. It was the climax of the story. Christ is the Lamb slain from before the foundation of the world. And he rose in his resurrection, demonstrating the vindication of all God's promises and the salvation of all God's people. And he pours out the Holy Spirit in his identity as the Spirit of Christ. The Spirit is gathering a church in the world and redeeming sinners and teaching integrity and faithfulness to the people of God, to people who once were corrupt and dirty with sin before God. This Spirit stamps the pattern of Jesus in the lives of his own. Is the world hostile to you right now? The Apostle Peter wrote to Christians exiled and living in the Roman Empire, who were surprised at their suffering. He says in 1 Peter 4:12, "Beloved, don't think it strange concerning this fiery trial, which is testing you," as if something strange, something unexplainable is happening. "But you rejoice, since you're partakers of Christ's sufferings. When his glory shall be revealed, you also will rejoice with exceeding joy." If you're insulted for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Therefore, he says, let those who suffer according to the will of God, yes, suffering, Christian suffering is according to the will of God. Let people who suffer this way commit the keeping of their souls to him and keep on doing good. The very fiery trial inflicted on God's Daniels in this world is proof The Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Where are you in all this? You are either faithfully being built on the grace and redemption and power of this God in Christ, or you're hostile to God and following sin. There is no middle road. Maybe you want to say, I think it's too late for me. I could never become a Daniel. Or maybe you say, I've compromised too much. Then the gospel answer for you is not to slam the door and not to say, well, you can't jump as high as Daniel, but to point you to the God of Daniel, revealed most fully in Jesus Christ. He died for sinners and the unfaithful. Flee to him for refuge, and he will make his redeeming power and faithfulness the rock on which he begins to build your faithfulness now in this present world. Christ is not ashamed to save sinners still. He wasn't ashamed to die for sinners. Much less then will he be ashamed to redeem sinners and make sinners faithful by his Spirit and his grace. In that light, a faithful God can produce faithful Daniels, even from people who've messed it all up. And it's the God of Daniel that is proclaimed to you in this chapter.